ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Do you ever look at your kids and think, they've got it easy? Life was so much harder back in my day. Well, have I got the podcast for you. It's called Wait, They Did What? We take a trip back in time to when kids could buy fireworks, cars didn't have seatbelts, and we all had to sing God Save the Queen.
They did what?
They did what?
They did
what?
I can't believe that.
Check it out with your kids. Wait, They Did What? Is on ABC Listen and ABC iView.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Awabakal and Gadigal people. G'day, Matt Bevan here. This is If You're Listening. I got a message on the weekend from a listener who said that there should have been some kind of warning before Thursday's episode on Australia's history of gas deals, making sure people had taken their blood pressure medication before listening. And judging by the flood of emails we've had since that episode aired, it seems that a lot of people feel the same way. There's real frustration that as a resource-rich country, Australia isn't faring better in this crisis. At the moment, we are still relying on oil that passed through the Strait of Hormuz before this whole crisis began. The last tankers to leave the Persian Gulf before the conflict are set to arrive in Australia right about now, this week. But it's not just the domestic situation that's making hair stand on end. The entire global energy market seems to be losing its mind. We're recording this at lunchtime on Monday, the 20th of April, and the price of oil is about $95 a barrel. But by the time you're listening to this, it could really be anywhere between $80 and $120. The US stock market is up about 10% over the last week or so, but it could be about to drop, depending on how peace negotiations in Pakistan go over the next few hours. The volatility is extraordinary. To help us make sense of all of this, or at least try, I'm joined by ABC senior business correspondent Carrington Clark. He hosts the ABC's two newest podcasts, ABC Business Daily and Fuelcast. He also used to be the ABC's North America correspondent based in Washington, D.C. So there may be no one at the ABC better placed to talk about this than Carrington. Carrington, hello.
Gosh, I mean, I hope I can live up to that introduction. I will try my very best, but no guarantees given that I will be able to make sense of this because smarter and much better paid people than I are struggling to understand exactly what's going on.
Take us through your understanding of what's been going on over the weekend, because it's been a wild few days in terms of the openness or closedness of the Strait of Hormuz.
Yeah, the last 5 days have been extraordinarily volatile. Now, the weekend kind of started with great optimism, great hope.
The Strait of Hormuz is fully open and ready for business and full passage.
The Strait of Hormuz, this important choke point for the world's energy supply that we've all become so now intimately involved or engaged with, was back open for business. But that was very short-lived. The issue seemed to be America said, well, their blockade wasn't actually going to be lifted. Their blockade was on ships going to Iran's ports and trying to transport either goods from or to Iran. And so then Iran said, well, if you're not going to lift your blockade, then we're not going to allow ships connected to other countries to continue traveling through the Strait of Hormuz.
This means a violation of the ceasefire. If it continues, Iran will take the necessary measures with the Strait of Hormuz.
And they followed up their threat by actually firing on ships that were trying to pass through the Strait of Hormuz.
Second on your list. You are firing now. Let me turn back.
And then we saw this extraordinary escalation where the US actually both fired at an Iranian-flagged cargo ship and then took control of it.
Motor vessel Tosca, vacate your engine room. Vacate your engine room. We're prepared to subject you to disabling fire.
So you've got live fire once again, either in the Strait of Hormuz or around it. Ships can't pass through. There is no normalization. And so this huge plunge that we saw, particularly of the oil price, because of the strait apparently being opened up, was reversed. Well, It was half reversed, is what I would say. So we dropped about 10%. It's gone up about 5 to 6% again, which does still suggest that markets are more positive than they were before last weekend about the situation. But I don't really understand exactly why that would be.
Exactly. Why? Why are people thinking that we can believe anything that either side is saying is the thing? And people are betting on it, putting huge amounts of money into the market based on the word of people that we know have been wrong many times lately.
So I think part of what is going on is the pervading kind of wisdom in markets has been that Donald Trump's instincts are to be making policies that make people more money. He is obsessed with being the president that oversees a rising stock market.
If you look at the stock markets up, everything's doing really well.
He was talking about this even last week, about stock market going over 7,000 points. This is the S&P 500 above 7,000 points. The NASDAQ hitting all-time records. This is something that means something to him, and he uses it as a gauge of his success. So what investors seem to be betting on is, in the end, what he will want to do is the thing that makes companies more money and makes the stock market go up. And so any sign that we're closer to a ceasefire agreement or an end to this war or some sort of agreement that allows ships to once again pass through the Straits of Hormuz is jumped on by the markets as being, okay, this is the point where we start to see Donald Trump pulling away from this war and finding ways for the market to make more money. So if we compare this to what happened, for example, with the so-called Liberation Day tariffs.
April 2nd, 2025 will forever be remembered as the day American industry was reborn, the day that we began to make America wealthy again. Gonna make it wealthy.
Good now, there was a huge sell-off in the market at that point.
That was almost exactly a year ago, wasn't it?
Exactly. And so it was quite a shocking announcement, even though it was in line with what he'd kind of promised through the campaign. And we did see market sell-offs, but Donald Trump didn't seem to be wavering. And people thought, oh, is this a different Donald Trump than the first term, where any sort of market sell-offs would have an impact on his decision-making and he would change tack? But what did eventually seem to change his mind was that we saw changes in the bond market and the interest that America was going to be paying on its debt. In the end, though, people still took from that lesson, and this is kind of when we got the so-called taco trade going into effect, which is that Trump always chickens out, that Donald Trump will talk a big game, but eventually he will move away from it if it looks like it's hurting the market, it's hurting the American economy. But the difference between what happened then and what is happening now is, in that case, Donald Trump could very easily lift the tariffs.
Yes,
it was one-sided. He could be the man to dictate that. What we're seeing at the moment play out is that Iran isn't letting Donald Trump just get away with dictating what's going on in the Strait of Hormuz.
Yeah, right, right.
He can declare it open, but Iran is saying, well, it's not open, actually.
In a statement read out on state TV, the new supreme leader warning that new bitter defeats were now coming for the US and Israel.
And that is why we're seeing this interruption once again to energy flow. But yet the market still seems to be assuming that this will all be tidied up pretty quickly because Donald Trump will want to extricate himself from the situation.
And the other thing is, when we say Iran declares the strait open or closed, the way that the Iranian regime designed, sort of as a fail-safe mechanism, the distribution of authority to lots of different parts of the country means that this Iranian official says the strait's open, but that doesn't mean that every single little boat in the Iranian Navy is going to agree with him. I mean, we saw this over the weekend. There was a clip that was circulating of an Iranian Navy officer basically saying to ships in the Strait of Hormuz, actually, the Strait of Hormuz isn't open.
This is Iranian Sepah Navy calling on Channel 16. The Strait of Hormuz is still closed. We will open it by the order of our leader, Imam Khamenei, not by the tweets of some idiot.
The strait will not be opened by the tweets of some idiot. And the interesting thing, of course, was that there was then subsequent debate about which idiot he was talking about, whether it was the Iranian foreign minister or whether it was Donald Trump.
Yes.
But the idea that due to some agreement reached in Islamabad, suddenly, oh yes, straits open, all good. Everybody's going to pack up their stuff and put it away and it'll all be back to normal, seems potentially not the way it's going to roll.
Yeah, I think that's right. Donald Trump likes to talk about there having already been regime change. Most experts say that is not the case. Yes, there have been leaders killed, but the regime, the Islamic regime, is still in place.
Yes.
And is in control of the country. And there is confusion, perhaps, about exactly who has ultimate say.
Because at the moment, we don't even know if the supreme leader is healthy.
Exactly.
There's rumors going around that he's in a coma or that he's gravely injured. And that sort of leaves it in the hands of individual boat captains to decide what they are and are not going to shoot at. It's extraordinary. The other interesting thing, and I hate to get into nerdy economics chat with you, Carrington.
Oh, please do.
You were saying that, you know, 20% of the world's oil and gas comes out of the Strait of Hormuz. The price of petrol has gone up way more than 20%. So I think there's a lot of confusion as to exactly what the prices that we're paying for fuel mean and what that price signal is trying to do in terms of bringing down demand. Can you explain your understanding of what's going on?
In the end, the iron laws of economics should win out, right? Which is prices about the crossover between supply and demand. One of the reasons this is a confusing market is that we talk about the futures price for Brent crude, which is the numbers that most people get quoted, but it's also been noted that the spot price, so how expensive is it for me right now to try to buy a tanker worth of crude that's easily available,
yeah.
The difference between those two prices actually has exploded because there's a real premium on getting it right now,
yes,
as opposed to agreeing that I'm going to get it in June or July. And so we're seeing quite huge dislocations in the market because of that. The oil market is also particularly complicated, right, because it doesn't even really pretend to be a free market. We literally have OPEC there to help dictate how much supply goes up, and there is a focus on keeping a price that they like for a range of different strategic reasons and financial reasons. And then there is a real concern, as you said in the start of this episode, about, well, what happens when we actually run out of those ships that were traveling before this interruption? And Donald Trump will be hearing this from his economic advisors that actually there is a potential pinch point coming, a choke point coming. And that would be part of the motivation to get this agreement in place, because there is a concern that not only can we see ever higher prices keep going up, but potentially you just don't see enough actual crude oil in order to refine the fuel that we need. Now, it appears that the one that most people are concerned about is aviation fuel. So that's jet fuel in particular, or ag gas, the two kind of different types of aviation fuel, that we could see issues around that at some point. But yeah, we're into unknown territory right now, and it's unclear exactly how long this is going to take to play out and what that means for the global economy.
As I think you said on ABC Business Daily last week, one of the tricks about jet fuel is I can decide to ride my bike instead of driving somewhere. I can take the train. There's lots of things that I can do instead of driving my car. But there's not a lot that I can do instead of flying. You know, if I need to go to Singapore or if I need to go to London,
yeah,
there's a lot fewer options. It's interesting, though, that you talk about the oil market not being a truly free market, and, you know, you have OPEC and you have these other countries, oil producers, sort of deciding how much oil are we going to sell at what price in order to maximize our strategic position, our income. We did an episode of If You're Listening last week, which was basically about Australia's gas exports, our LNG exports. The realization that I think we came to is that our strategy appears to be how much gas and where do you want it and when? And we'll provide it to you. Absolutely, absolutely. No question about whether we will hold some of it back or increase production in order to take advantage of something. We will shovel every bit of the resource out of the country as quickly as possible. Is that basically the way that we roll here in Australia? We dig it up and get it out of here as quickly as we can without trying to manipulate the market at all?
I think the Australian government's position has been that the government doesn't interfere with the decisions of those companies that have been licensed to basically exploit that resource, right? That they're making the decisions based on how they can maximize their product, but it's done in a competitive environment. Now, yes, there is a huge debate, and it may well play out in this budget, about whether or not that is the right policy, or particularly when it comes to the taxation of that resource, which is a slightly separate issue about whether or not you're involving yourself in, say, cartel behavior, or whether or not you're doing a reservation policy, which is also a slightly separate thing. But yes, I think up until this point, at least, the Australian government's position has been, we do not interfere with that market. We allow the companies to sell it, and the price is set through that interaction of supply and demand. But that is not the way that other countries have done it. And when you compare to, say, the Norway example, where they do have a huge amount of revenue for their sovereign wealth fund coming from their resources. People look at that and say, well, shouldn't Australia be getting a bigger share of that? There are also many domestic companies who say, well, how come we don't get a bigger amount of that resource reserved for Australian businesses, effectively at a reduced price than the international price for gas, to help our businesses compete by having a lower cost of energy? Those are all interesting debates that have obviously flared up at this time. But yes, Australia has made a very deliberate decision that we're not part of any international cartels.
Okay, rightio. What are the big issues that are facing the Australian government in terms of deciding how to proceed? There are various parties pushing for either increased taxation of our exports or not. But that's obviously playing second fiddle a little bit to the government just trying to make sure that we're going to have enough fuel coming into the country. What do you think is on the mind of the government as they proceed through this crisis and towards the budget, which is, you know, a time that they get to basically set financial policy for the next year?
It has been interesting watching how this has played out kind of in real time, right? Because at the beginning, I think the government's focus was on trying to assure people that there's plenty of fuel, you're not going to run out of fuel, calm people down so that we didn't see a run on petrol stations. The government also very firmly rejected suggestions at the beginning of this price surge that Australia needed to have a bigger reservation of fuel. You know, we talk about the 90 days recommended by the International Energy Agency. The government said, well, that's too expensive. It's $20 billion. We can't afford that effectively.
Yeah.
I think that is maybe changing. The speculation that perhaps the government will be looking at a bigger reservation. This does feel like an inflection point when it comes to, for example, the uptake of electric vehicles. We've seen a huge increase in both inquiries about electric vehicles, but also purchase of electric vehicles. So I think that is interesting, and probably see some things, it sounds like, around the tax breaks for electric vehicles potentially. But I think, yes, this obviously, it made very clear to people about how vulnerable we still are to oil price shocks and how vulnerable we are to any cutoff of supply of refined fuels. And obviously the question about, well, does Australia have enough refinery capability if we've only got two left? We used to be an exporter of oil and now we're reliant on the import of crude oil for those refineries, but also of refined petrol. So I think those are interesting questions. Many people would say, well, this should motivate us to move even quicker towards renewable energy here in Australia. Now, Australia is a major energy exporter. We like talking about this, of coal, we export natural gas, we also export uranium. You know, we are a massive energy player, but here at home, we are still reliant on these refined fuels from elsewhere. And so the question is, how do you mitigate against that risk and how do you ensure that you aren't as vulnerable? And I think that'll be part of the question for the government as they try to shape this budget.
You know, and we talked a little bit about this last week. There is electrification of passenger vehicles and of small vehicles. But a few people have contacted us to say that I wasn't quite right in saying that we don't really have any short, medium, or long-term plans to replace diesel as the source of power for our logistics sector and for our agricultural sector and that kind of thing. I possibly was wrong in saying long. There obviously are some discussions about electric-powered trucks and electric-powered farm machinery and that kind of thing, but it's still not something the government is looking at investing in, replacing our fleet of trucks with electric trucks in the foreseeable future at least. We can talk as much about electrification as we want, but in terms of these other sectors, we're going to still need diesel for a while.
I think that's right. And also, we're only a year and a bit into Donald Trump's term, right? We've still got multiple years of just Donald Trump being in power. And during that time, Australia is definitely not going to move away from needing to use refined fuels. So I think there is a question, if you think of Donald Trump period as being particularly dangerous or precarious when it comes to conflicts, particularly in that region, what are you doing over the next 2 to 3 years to ensure that Australia isn't as vulnerable to being cut off from refined fuels? Is there anything the government can do in the short term? You know, that is a big question, I think. And yes, you hope that this war comes to an end soon, but if it isn't, can Australia get through these next couple of years of the Donald Trump term?
Yeah, get your bike repaired. Make sure that you've got the right type of walking shoes for the next few months. But hopefully we won't need to deploy all that. Hopefully we'll be okay.
Well, I've always encouraged people to walk.
That's right. I've had a number of bike rides over the last few weeks and it's been great. I've really enjoyed it.
Good place to hear it.
But we'll see how it feels in the middle of winter. Carrington, I feel like we could keep on talking all day, but you have multiple podcasts to make. I have one to make. Yes. So I'll let you go. Thank you so much for coming on. And I'm really enjoying listening to Business Daily and Fuelcast as well. It's a rich new podcast feed that is available to people on the ABC Listen app. Thank you so much, Carrington.
Thanks, mate. Talk to you soon.
Carrington's episode is coming out, well, every day. That's why it's called ABC Business Daily. You can hear him then. We'll be back on Thursday with our new episode, which is about the difficulties that Donald Trump is facing in trying to strike a long-term peace agreement with Iran and comparing it to previous peace negotiations in the past. We'll catch you then.